One story I was certainly not able to read was in the Johannesburg Sunday Post in March 1980. The headline was, Free Mandela. Inside was a petition that people could sign to ask for my release and that of my fellow political prisoners, while newspapers were still barred from printing my picture or any words I had ever said or written. The Post's campaign ignited a public discussion of our release. The idea had been conceived in Lusaka by Oliver and the ANC, and the campaign was the cornerstone of a new strategy that would put our cause in the forefront of people's minds. The ANC had decided to personalize the quest for our release by centering the campaign on a single figure. There is no doubt that the millions of people who subsequently became supporters of this campaign had no idea of precisely who Nelson Mandela was. I am told that when Free Mandela posters went up in London, most young people thought my Christian name was Free. There were a handful of dissenting voices on the island who felt that personalizing the campaign was a betrayal of the collectivity of the organization. But most people realized that it was a technique to rouse the people. The previous year, I had been awarded the Jawaharlal Nehru Human Rights Award in India, another bit of evidence of the resurgence of the struggle. I was, of course, refused permission to attend the ceremony, as was Winnie, but Oliver accepted the award in my absence. We had a sense of a reviving ANC. Umkhonto Wesizwe was stepping up its sabotage campaign, which had become far more sophisticated. In June, MK set off bombs at the vast Sasolburg refinery just south of Johannesburg. MK was orchestrating an explosion a week at some strategic site or another. Bombs exploded at power stations in the eastern Transvaal, at police stations in Germiston, Daveyton, New Brighton, and elsewhere, and at the Voortrekkerhoed military base outside Pretoria. These were all strategically significant locations, places that would attract attention and worry the state. The defense minister, General Magnus Malan, backed by P.W. Botha, introduced a policy known as Total Onslaught, which was a militarization of the country to combat the liberation struggle. The Free Mandela campaign had its lighter side as well. In 1981, I learned that the students at the University of London had nominated me as a candidate for the honorific post of University Chancellor. This was a wonderful honor, to be sure, and my rivals were none other than Princess Anne and the trade union leader Jack Jones. In the end, I polled 7,199 votes and lost to the daughter of the Queen. I wrote to Winnie and Branford that I hoped the voting might have for a moment turned her humble shack into a castle, making its tiny rooms as grand as the ballroom at Windsor. The campaign for our release rekindled our hopes. During the hush days of the early 1970s, when the ANC seemed to sink into the shadows, we had to force ourselves not to give in to despair. In many ways, we had miscalculated. We had thought that by the 1970s we would be living in a democratic, non-racial South Africa. Yet as we entered the new decade, my hopes for that South Africa rose once again. Some mornings I walked out into the courtyard, and every living thing there, the seagulls and wagtails, the small trees, and even the stray blades of grass, seemed to smile and shine in the sun. It was at such times when I perceived the beauty of even this small, closed-in corner of the world, that I knew that someday my people and I would be free. Chapter 86. Like my father before me, I had been groomed to be a counselor to the king of the Tembu. Although I had chosen a different path, I tried in my own fashion to live up to the responsibilities of the role for which I had been schooled. From prison, I did my best to remain in contact with the king and advise him as best I could. As I grew older, my thoughts turned more and more often to the green hills of the Transkei. Although I would never move there under the government's auspices, I dreamed of one day returning to a free Transkei. Thus it was with great dismay that I learned in 1980 that the king, Sabata Dalinjebo, the paramount chief of the Tembu, had been deposed by my nephew, K.D. Matanzima, the prime minister of the Transkei. A group of Tembu chiefs requested an urgent visit with me, which was approved by the authorities, who were usually willing to countenance visits by traditional leaders, believing that the more involved I was in tribal and Transkei matters, the less committed I would be to the struggle. The government promoted the power of traditional leaders as a counterpoint to the ANC. While many of my comrades thought we should disavow those leaders, my inclination was to reach out to them. There is no contradiction between being a traditional leader and a member of the ANC. This spurred one of the longest and most delicate debates we had on the island, whether or not the ANC should participate in government-sponsored institutions. Many of the men considered this collaborationist. Once again, I thought it necessary to draw a distinction between principle and tactics. To me, the critical question was a tactical one. Will our organization emerge stronger through participating in these organizations or by boycotting them? In this case, I thought we would emerge stronger by participating. I met with the chiefs in a large room in the visiting area, and they explained their dilemma. Although their hearts were with Sabata, they feared Matanzima. After listening to their presentation, I advised them to throw their support to Sabata against Matanzima, who was illegally and shamefully usurping power from the king. I sympathized with their situation, but I could not condone Matanzima's actions. I asked them to convey my support to Sabata and my disapproval to Matanzima. Matanzima had also proposed a visit to discuss Sabata and family matters. As my nephew, he had actually been requesting such a visit for a number of years. Although Matanzima claimed to want to discuss family matters, such a visit would have political consequences. From the moment of Matanzima's first request, I referred the matter to the high organ and the ANC men in our section. Some simply shrugged their shoulders and said, "He's your nephew. He has a right to visit." Raymond, Govan, and Kathy, however, insisted that although such a visit could be explained away as a family matter, it would be interpreted by many people inside and outside as a sign of my endorsement of the man and his policies. That was the reason why Matanzima wanted to visit, and the reason such a visit was unacceptable. I understood and in large part agreed with their arguments, but I wanted to meet with my nephew. I have always had perhaps too high a regard for the importance of face-to-face meetings and of my own ability in such a meeting to persuade men to change their views. I was hoping I could convince Matanzima to modify his policies. Eventually, the ANC men in our section decided not to object to a visit. In the interests of democracy, we then consulted with our men in F and G on the matter, and they were adamantly opposed. Steve Schwete, who was one of the leading ANC figures in the general section, said such a visit would help Matanzima politically and was therefore out of the question. Many of them noted that Matanzima had already tried to co-opt my approval by making Winnie's father, Columbus Madikizela, the Minister of Agriculture in his government. This was bad enough, they said, without Madiba agreeing to see him. I bowed to the views of the membership in the general section and regretfully informed the authorities that I would not accept a visit from my nephew. In March of 1982, I was told by the prison authorities that my wife had been in a car accident and that she was in hospital. They had very little information, and I had no idea of her condition or what her circumstances were. I accused the authorities of holding back information, and I made an urgent application for my attorney to visit me. The authorities used information as a weapon, and it was a successful one. I was preoccupied with my wife's health until I was visited on March 31st by Winnie's attorney and my friend, Dulla Omar. Dulla quickly eased my mind about Winnie. She had been in a car that overturned, but she was all right. Our visit was brief, and as I was led back to Section B, my mind was still dwelling on Winnie, and I was plagued by the feeling of powerlessness and my inability to help her. I had not been in my cell long when I was visited by the commanding officer and a number of other prison officials. This was highly unusual. The commanding officer did not generally pay calls on prisoners in their cells. I stood up when they arrived, and the commander actually entered my cell. There was barely room for the two of us. "Mandela," he said, "I want you to pack up your things." I asked him why. "We are transferring you," he said simply.
"Where?"
"I cannot say," he replied. I demanded to know why. He told me only that he had received instructions from Pretoria that I was to be transferred off the island immediately. The commanding officer left and went in turn to the cells of Walter, Raymond Mhlaba, and Andrew Mlangeni, and gave them the same order. I was disturbed and unsettled. What did it mean? Where were we going? In prison, one can only question and resist an order to a certain point. Then one must succumb. We had no warning, no preparation. I had been on the island for over 18 years, and to leave so abruptly? We were each given several large cardboard boxes in which to pack our things. Everything that I had accumulated in nearly 2 decades could fit in these few boxes. We packed in little more than half an hour. There was a commotion in the corridor when the other men learned we were leaving, but we had no time to say a proper goodbye to our comrades of many years. This is another one of the indignities of prison. The bonds of friendship and loyalty with other prisoners count for nothing with the authorities. Within minutes, we were on board the ferry headed for Cape Town. I looked back at the island as the light was fading, not knowing whether or not I would ever see it again. A man can get used to anything, and I had grown used to Robben Island. I had lived there for almost 2 decades, and while it was never a home, my home was in Johannesburg, it had become a place where I felt comfortable. I have always found change difficult, and leaving Robben Island, however grim it had been at times, was no exception. I had no idea what to look forward to. At the docks, surrounded by armed guards, we were hustled into a windowless truck. The four of us stood in the dark while the truck drove for what seemed considerably longer than an hour. We passed through various checkpoints and finally came to a stop. The back doors swung open, and in the dark we were marched up some concrete steps and through metal doors into another security facility. I managed to ask a guard where we were. "Polesmoor Prison," he said. Part 10. Talking with the Enemy. Chapter 87. Polesmoor Maximum Security Prison is located on the edge of a prosperous white suburb of green lawns and tidy houses called Tokai, a few miles southeast of Cape Town. The prison itself is set amidst the strikingly beautiful scenery of the Cape, between the mountains of Constantiaberg to the north and hundreds of acres of vineyards to the south. But this natural beauty was invisible to us behind Polesmoor's high concrete walls. At Polesmoor, I first understood the truth of Oscar Wilde's haunting line about the tent of blue that prisoners call the sky. Polesmoor had a modern face but a primitive heart. The buildings, particularly the ones for the prison staff, were clean and contemporary, but the housing for the prisoners was archaic and dirty. With the exception of ourselves, all men at Polesmoor were common law prisoners, and their treatment was backward. We were kept separately from them and treated differently. It was not until the next morning that we got a proper sense of our surroundings. The four of us had been given what was in effect the prison's penthouse, a spacious room on the third and topmost floor of the prison. We were the only prisoners on the entire floor. The main room was clean, modern, and rectangular, about 50 feet by 30, and had a separate section with a toilet, urinal, 2 sinks, and 2 showers. There were 4 proper beds with sheets and towels, a great luxury for men who had spent much of the last 18 years sleeping on thin mats on a stone floor. Compared to Robben Island, we were in a 5-star hotel. We also had our own L-shaped terrace, an open outdoor section that was as long as half a soccer field, where we were allowed out during the day. It had white concrete walls about 12 feet high so that we could see only the sky, except in one corner where we could make out the ridges of the Constantiaberg Mountains, in particular a section known as the Elephant's Eye. I sometimes thought of this bit of mountain as the tip of the iceberg of the rest of the world. It was greatly disorienting to be uprooted so suddenly and without explanation. One must be prepared for precipitate movements in prison, but one does not ever get used to them. Though we were now on the mainland, we felt more isolated. For us, the island had become the locus of the struggle. We took solace in each other's company and spent those early weeks speculating on why we had been transferred. We knew the authorities had long resented and feared the influence we had on younger prisoners, but the reason seemed to be more strategic. We believed the authorities were attempting to cut off the head of the ANC on the island by removing its leadership. Robben Island itself was becoming a sustaining myth in the struggle, and they wanted to rob it of some of its symbolic import by removing us. Walter, Raymond, and I were members of the High Organ, but the one piece that did not fit was the presence of Mlangeni. Andrew was not a member of the High Organ and had not been in the forefront of the island leadership, although we considered the possibility that the authorities did not know this. Their intelligence about the organization was often inexact. One of our hypotheses seemed to be confirmed a few months later when we were joined by Kathy, who had indeed been a member of the High Organ. More important, Kathy had been our chief of communications, and it was because of his work that we were able to communicate with new, young prisoners. A few weeks after Kathy arrived, we were also joined by a man we did not know, who had not even come from Robben Island. Patrick Mkabela was a young lawyer and ANC member from the Eastern Cape. He had been articled to Griffiths Mkenge, a highly respected attorney who had appeared for many detained ANC men and who had been assassinated near Durban the year before. Mkabela was serving a 20-year sentence for treason and had been transferred to Polesmoor from Deep Kloof in Johannesburg, where he had made waves by organizing prisoners. At first, we were skeptical of this new arrival and wondered if he could perhaps be a security plant by the authorities. But we soon saw that this was not the case. Patrick was a bright, amiable, undaunted fellow with whom we got along very well. It could not have been easy for him bunking in with a group of old men set in their ways who had been together for the previous 2 decades. We were now in a world of concrete. I missed the natural splendor of Robben Island, but our new home had many consolations. For one thing, the food at Polesmoor was far superior. After years of eating pep 3 meals a day, Polesmoor's dinners of proper meat and vegetables were like a feast. We were permitted a fairly wide range of newspapers and magazines and could receive such previously contraband publications as Time magazine and The Guardian weekly from London. This gave us a window on the wider world. We also had a radio, but one that received only local stations, not what we really wanted, the BBC World Service. We were allowed out on our terrace all day long, except between 12 and 2 when the warders had their lunch. There was not even a pretense that we had to work. I had a small cell near our large one that functioned as a study with a chair, desk and bookshelves where I could read and write during the day. On Robben Island, I would do my exercises in my own cramped cell, but now I had room to stretch out. At Polesmoor, I would wake up at 5 and do an hour and a half of exercise in our communal cell. I did my usual regimen of stationary running, skipping rope, sit-ups, and fingertip press-ups. My comrades were not early risers, and my program soon made me a very unpopular fellow in our cell. I was visited by Winnie shortly after arriving at Polesmoor, and was pleased to find that the visiting area was far better and more modern than the one on Robben Island. We had a large glass barrier through which one could see the visitor from the waist up, and far more sophisticated microphones, so that we did not have to strain to hear. The window gave at least the illusion of greater intimacy, and in prison, illusions can offer comfort. It was far easier for my wife and family to get to Polesmoor than Robben Island, and this made a tremendous difference. The supervision of visits also became more humane. Often, Winnie's visits were overseen by Warrant Officer James Gregory, who had been a censor on Robben Island. I had not known him terribly well, but he knew us, because he had been responsible for reviewing our incoming and outgoing mail. At Polesmoor, I got to know Gregory better and found him a welcome contrast to the typical warder. He was polished and soft-spoken, and treated Winnie with courtesy and deference. Instead of barking, "Time up," he would say, "Mrs. Mandela, you have 5 more minutes." The Bible tells us that gardens preceded gardeners, but that was not the case at Polesmoor, where I cultivated a garden that became one of my happiest diversions. It was my way of escaping from the monolithic concrete world that surrounded us. Within a few weeks of surveying all the empty space we had on the building's roof and how it was bathed in sun the whole day, I decided to start a garden and received permission to do so from the commanding officer. I requested that the prison service supply me with 16 44-gallon oil drums that I had them slice in half. The authorities then filled each half with rich, moist soil, creating, in effect, 32 giant flower pots. I grew onions, eggplant, cabbage, cauliflower, beans, spinach, carrots, cucumbers, broccoli, beetroot, lettuce, tomatoes, peppers, strawberries, and much more. At its height, I had a small farm with nearly 900 plants, a garden far grander than the one I had on Robben Island. Some of the seeds I purchased, and some, for example, broccoli and carrots, were given to me by the commanding officer, Brigadier Monroe, who was particularly fond of these vegetables. Warders also gave me seeds of vegetables they liked, and I was supplied with excellent manure to use as fertilizer. Each morning I put on a straw hat and rough gloves and worked in the garden for 2 hours. Every Sunday I would supply vegetables to the kitchen so that they could cook a special meal for the common law prisoners. I also gave quite a lot of my harvest to the warders, who used to bring satchels to take away their fresh vegetables. At Polesmoor, our problems tended to be less consequential than those we experienced on Robben Island. Brigadier Monroe was a decent, helpful man who took extra pains to make sure we had what we wanted. Nevertheless, small problems sometimes got blown out of proportion. In 1983, during a visit with Winnie and Zinzi, I mentioned to my wife that I had been given shoes that were a size too small and were pinching my toe. Winnie was concerned, and I soon learned that there were press reports that I was having a toe amputated. Because of the difficulty of communication, information from prison often becomes exaggerated in the outside world. If I had simply been able to telephone my wife and tell her that my foot was fine, such confusion would not have happened. A short while later, Helen Suzman was permitted to visit, and she inquired about my toe. I thought the best answer was a demonstration. I took off my socks, held my bare foot up to the glass, and wiggled my toes. We complained about the dampness in our cell, which was causing us to catch colds. Later, I heard reports that South African newspapers were writing that our cell was flooded. We asked for contact with other prisoners, and in general made the same basic complaint that we always had, to be treated as political prisoners. In May of 1984, I found some consolation that seemed to make up for all the discomforts. At a scheduled visit from Winnie, Zenny, and her youngest daughter, I was escorted down to the visiting area by Sergeant Gregory, who, instead of taking me to the normal visiting area, ushered me into a separate room where there was only a small table and no dividers of any kind. He very softly said to me that the authorities had made a change. That day was the beginning of what were known as contact visits. He then went outside to see my wife and daughter and asked to speak to Winnie privately. Winnie actually got a fright when Gregory took her aside, thinking that I was perhaps ill. But Gregory escorted her around the door, and before either of us knew it, we were in the same room and in each other's arms. I kissed and held my wife for the first time in all these many years. It was a moment I had dreamed about a thousand times. It was as if I were still dreaming. I held her to me for what seemed like an eternity. We were still and silent, except for the sound of our hearts. I did not want to let go of her at all. But I broke free and embraced my daughter, and then took her child into my lap. It had been 21 years since I had even touched my wife's hand. Chapter 88. At Polesmoor, we were more connected to outside events. We were aware that the struggle was intensifying and that the efforts of the enemy were similarly increasing. In 1981, the South African Defense Force launched a raid on ANC offices in Maputo, Mozambique, killing 13 of our people, including women and children. In December 1982, MK set off explosions at the unfinished Coburg nuclear power plant outside Cape Town and placed bombs at many other military and apartheid targets around the country. That same month, the South African military again attacked an ANC outpost in Maseru, Lesotho, killing 42 people, including a dozen women and children. In August of 1982, activist Ruth First was opening her mail in Maputo, where she was living in exile, when she was murdered by a letter bomb. Ruth, the wife of Joe Slovo, was a brave anti-apartheid activist who had spent a number of months in prison. She was a forceful, engaging woman whom I first met when I was studying at Wits, and her death revealed the extent of the state's cruelty in combating our struggle. MK's first car bomb attack took place in May of 1983 and was aimed at an Air Force and military intelligence office in the heart of Pretoria. This was an effort to retaliate for the unprovoked attacks the military had launched on the ANC in Maseru and elsewhere, and was a clear escalation of the armed struggle. 19 people were killed and more than 200 injured. The killing of civilians was a tragic accident, and I felt a profound horror at the death toll. But as disturbed as I was by these casualties, I knew that such accidents were the inevitable consequence of the decision to embark on a military struggle. Human fallibility is always a part of war, and the price for it is always high. It was precisely because we knew that such incidents would occur that our decision to take up arms had been so grave and reluctant. But as Oliver said at the time of the bombing, the armed struggle was imposed upon us by the violence of the apartheid regime. Both the government and the ANC were working on two tracks, military and political. On the political front, the government was pursuing its standard divide-and-rule strategy in attempting to separate Africans from coloureds and Indians. In a referendum of November 1983, the white electorate endorsed P.W. Botha's plan to create a so-called tricameral parliament with Indian and coloured chambers in addition to the white parliament. This was an effort to lure Indians and coloureds into the system and divide them from Africans. But the offer was merely a toy telephone, as all parliamentary action by Indians and coloureds was subject to a white veto. It was also a way of fooling the outside world into thinking that the government was reforming apartheid. Botha's ruse did not fool the people, as more than 80% of eligible Indian and coloured voters boycotted the election to the new Houses of Parliament in 1984. powerful grassroots political movements were being formed inside the country that had firm links to the ANC, the principal one being the United Democratic Front, of which I was named a patron. The UDF had been created to coordinate protest against the new apartheid constitution in 1983, and the first elections to the segregated tricameral parliament in 1984. The UDF soon blossomed into a powerful organization that united over 600 anti-apartheid organizations, trade unions, community groups, church groups, student associations. The ANC was experiencing a new birth of popularity. Opinion polls showed that the Congress was far and away the most popular political organization among Africans, even though it had been banned for a quarter of a century. The anti-apartheid struggle as a whole had captured the attention of the world. In 1984, Bishop Desmond Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. The authorities refused to send Bishop Tutu my letter of congratulations. The South African government was under growing international pressure as nations all across the globe began to impose economic sanctions on Pretoria. The government had sent feelers to me over the years, beginning with Minister Krugert's efforts to persuade me to move to the Transkei. These were not efforts to negotiate, but attempts to isolate me from my organization. On several other occasions, Kruger said to me, "Mandela, we can work with you, but not your colleagues. Be reasonable." Although I did not respond to these overtures, the mere fact that they were talking rather than attacking could be seen as a prelude to genuine negotiations. The government was testing the waters. In late 1984 and early 1985, I had visits from two prominent Western statesmen, Lord Nicholas Bethell, a member of the British House of Lords and the European Parliament, and Samuel Dash, a professor of law at Georgetown University and a former counsel to the U.S. Senate Watergate Committee. Both visits were authorized by the new Minister of Justice, Kobi Kotze, who appeared to be a new sort of Afrikaner leader. I met Lord Bethell in the prison commander's office, which was dominated by a large photograph of a glowering President Botha. Bethell was a jovial, rotund man, and when I first met him, I teased him about his stoutness. "You look like you are related to Winston Churchill," I said as we shook hands, and he laughed. Lord Bethell wanted to know about our conditions at Polesmoor, and I told him. We discussed the armed struggle, and I explained to him it was not up to us to renounce violence, but the government. I reaffirmed that we aimed for hard military targets, not people. "I would not want our men to assassinate, for instance, the major here," I said, pointing to Major Fritz von Sittert, who was monitoring the talks. Von Sittert was a good-natured fellow who did not say much, but he started at my remark. In my visit with Professor Dash, which quickly followed that of Lord Bethell, I laid out what I saw as the minimum for a future non-racial South Africa, a unitary state without homelands, non-racial elections for the central parliament, and one person, one vote. Professor Dash asked me whether I took any encouragement from the government's stated intention of repealing the mixed marriage laws and certain other apartheid statutes. "This is a pinprick," I said. "It is not my ambition to marry a white woman or swim in a white pool. It is political equality that we want." I told Dash quite candidly that at the moment we could not defeat the government on the battlefield, but could make governing difficult for them. I had one not-so-pleasant visit from two Americans, editors of the conservative newspaper, The Washington Times. They seemed less intent on finding out my views than on proving that I was a communist and a terrorist. All of their questions were slanted in that direction, and when I reiterated that I was neither a communist nor a terrorist, they attempted to show that I was not a Christian either by asserting that the Reverend Martin Luther King never resorted to violence. I told them that the conditions in which Martin Luther King struggled were totally different from my own. The United States was a democracy with constitutional guarantees of equal rights that protected nonviolent protest. though there was still prejudice against blacks. South Africa was a police state with a constitution that enshrined inequality and an army that responded to nonviolence with force. I told them that I was a Christian and had always been a Christian. Even Christ, I said, when he was left with no alternative, used force to expel the moneylenders from the temple. He was not a man of violence, but had no choice but to use force against evil. I do not think I persuaded them. Faced with trouble at home and pressure from abroad, P.W. Botha offered a tepid halfway measure. On January 31, 1985, in a debate in Parliament, the state president publicly offered me my freedom if I unconditionally rejected violence as a political instrument. This offer was extended to all political prisoners. Then, as if he were staking me to a public challenge, he added, "It is therefore not the South Africa government which now stands in the way of Mr. Mandela's freedom. It is he himself." I had been warned by the authorities that the government was going to make a proposal involving my freedom, but I had not been prepared for the fact that it would be made in Parliament by the state president. By my reckoning, it was the sixth conditional offer the government had made for my release in the past 10 years. After I listened to the speech on radio, I made a request to the commander of the prison for an urgent visit by my wife and my lawyer, Ismail Ayob, so that I could dictate my response to the state president's offer. Winnie and Ismail were not given permission to visit for a week, and in the meantime I wrote a letter to the foreign minister, Pik Botha, rejecting the conditions for my release while also preparing a public response. I was keen to do a number of things in this response. Because Botha's offer was an attempt to drive a wedge between me and my colleagues by tempting me to accept a policy the ANC rejected, I wanted to reassure the ANC in general, and Oliver in particular, that my loyalty to the organization was beyond question. I also wished to send a message to the government that while I rejected its offer because of the conditions attached to it, I nevertheless thought negotiation, not war, was the path to a solution. Botha wanted the onus of violence to rest on my shoulders, and I wanted to reaffirm to the world that we were only responding to the violence done to us. I intended to make it clear that if I emerged from prison into the same circumstances in which I was arrested, I would be forced to resume the same activities for which I was arrested. I met with Winnie and Ismail on a Friday. On Sunday, a UDF rally was to be held in Soweto's Jabulani Stadium, where my response would be made public. Some guards with whom I was not familiar supervised the visit, and as we began discussing my response to the state president, one of the warders, a relatively young fellow, interrupted to say that only family matters were permitted to be discussed. I ignored him, and he returned minutes later with a senior warder whom I barely knew. This warder said that I must cease discussing politics, and I told him that I was dealing with a matter of national importance involving an offer from the state president. I warned him that if he wanted to halt the discussion, he must get direct orders from the state president himself. "If you are not willing to telephone the state president to get those orders," I said coldly, "then kindly do not interrupt us again." He did not. I gave Ismail and Winnie the speech I had prepared. In addition to responding to the government, I wanted to thank publicly the UDF for its fine work and to congratulate Bishop Tutu on his prize, adding that his award belonged to all the people. On Sunday, February 10, 1985, my daughter Zinzi read my response to a cheering crowd of people who had not been able to hear my words legally anywhere in South Africa for more than 20 years. Zinzi was a dynamic speaker like her mother, and said that her father should be at the stadium to speak the words himself. I was proud to know that it was she who spoke my words. "I am a member of the African National Congress. I have always been a member of the African National Congress, and I will remain a member of the African National Congress until the day I die. Oliver Tambo is more than a brother to me. He is my greatest friend and comrade for nearly 50 years. If there is anyone amongst you who cherishes my freedom, Oliver Tambo cherishes it more, and I know that he would give his life to see me free. I am surprised at the conditions that the government wants to impose on me. I am not a violent man. It was only then, when all other forms of resistance were no longer open to us, that we turned to armed struggle. Let Botha show that he is different to Malan, Strijdom, and Fervord. Let him renounce violence. Let him say that he will dismantle apartheid. Let him unban the People's Organization, the African National Congress. Let him free all who have been imprisoned, banished, or exiled for their opposition to apartheid. Let him guarantee free political activity so that people may decide who will govern them. I cherish my own freedom dearly, but I care even more for your freedom. Too many have died since I went to prison. Too many have suffered for the love of freedom. I owe it to their widows, to their orphans, to their mothers and to their fathers who have grieved and wept for them. Not only I have suffered during these long, lonely, wasted years. I am not less life-loving than you are, but I cannot sell my birthright, nor am I prepared to sell the birthright of the people to be free. What freedom am I being offered while the organization of the people remains banned? What freedom am I being offered when I may be arrested on a pass offense? What freedom am I being offered to live my life as a family with my dear wife who remains in banishment in Brantford? What freedom am I being offered when I must ask for permission to live in an urban area? What freedom am I being offered when my very South African citizenship is not respected? Only free men can negotiate. Prisoners cannot enter into contracts. I cannot and will not give any undertaking at a time when I and you, the people, are not free. Your freedom and mine cannot be separated. I will return.
Chapter 89. In 1985, after a routine medical examination with the prison doctor, I was referred to a urologist who diagnosed an enlarged prostate gland and recommended surgery. He said that the procedure was routine. I consulted with my family and decided to go ahead with the operation. I was taken to Volks Hospital in Cape Town under heavy security. Winnie flew down and was able to see me prior to the surgery. But I had another visitor, a surprising and unexpected one, Kobi Coetzee, the Minister of Justice. Not long before, I had written to Coetzee pressing him for a meeting to discuss talks between the ANC and the government. He did not respond. But that morning, the minister dropped by the hospital unannounced as if he were visiting an old friend who was laid up for a few days. He was altogether gracious and cordial, and for the most part we simply made pleasantries. Though I acted as though this was the most normal thing in the world, I was amazed. The government, in its slow and tentative way, was reckoning that they had to come to some accommodation with the ANC. Coetzee's visit was an olive branch. Although we did not discuss politics, I did bring up one sensitive issue, and that was the status of my wife. In August, shortly before I entered the hospital, Winnie had gone to Johannesburg to receive medical treatment. The only trips she was permitted from Brantford were to visit either me or her doctor. While in Johannesburg, her house in Brantford and the clinic behind it were firebombed and destroyed. Winnie had no place in which to reside, and she decided to remain in Johannesburg despite the fact that the city was off limits to her. Nothing happened for a few weeks, and then the security police wrote to inform her that the house in Brantford had been repaired and she must return. But she refused to do so. I asked Coetzee to allow Winnie to remain in Johannesburg and not force her to return to Brantford. He said he could promise nothing, but he would indeed look into it. I thanked him. I spent several days in hospital recuperating from the surgery. When I was discharged, I was fetched at the hospital by Brigadier Munro. Commanding officers do not usually pick up prisoners at the hospital, so my suspicions were immediately aroused. On the ride back, Brigadier Munro said to me in a casual way, as though he was simply making conversation, "Mandela, we are not taking you back to your friends now." I asked him what he meant. "From now on, you are going to be alone." I asked him why. He shook his head. "I don't know. I've just been given these instructions from headquarters." Once again, there was no warning and no explanation. Upon my return to Polesmoor, I was taken to a new cell on the ground floor of the prison, three floors below and in an entirely different wing. I was given three rooms and a separate toilet, with one room to be used for sleeping, one across the hall for studying, and another for exercise. By prison standards, this was palatial, but the rooms were damp and musty and received very little natural light. I said nothing to the brigadier, for I knew the decision had not been his. I wanted time to consider the ramifications of the move. Why had the state taken this step? It would be too strong to call it a revelation, but over the next few days and weeks, I came to a realization about my new circumstances. The change, I decided, was not a liability, but an opportunity. I was not happy to be separated from my colleagues, and I missed my garden and the sunny terrace on the third floor. But my solitude gave me a certain liberty, and I resolved to use it to do something I had been pondering for a long while, begin discussions with the government. I had concluded that the time had come when the struggle could best be pushed forward through negotiations. If we did not start a dialogue soon, both sides would be plunged into a dark night of oppression, violence, and war. My solitude would give me an opportunity to take the first steps in that direction, without the kind of scrutiny that might destroy such efforts. We had been fighting against white minority rule for three quarters of a century. We had been engaged in the armed struggle for more than two decades. Many people on both sides had already died. The enemy was strong and resolute. Yet even with all their bombers and tanks, they must have sensed they were on the wrong side of history. We had right on our side, but not yet might. It was clear to me that a military victory was a distant, if not impossible, dream. It simply did not make sense for both sides to lose thousands, if not millions, of lives in a conflict that was unnecessary. They must have known this as well. It was time to talk. This would be extremely sensitive. Both sides regarded discussion as a sign of weakness and betrayal. Neither would come to the table until the other made significant concessions. The government asserted over and over that we were a terrorist organization of communists, and that they would never talk to terrorists or communists. This was National Party dogma. The ANC asserted over and over that the government was fascistic and racist, and that there was nothing to talk about until they unbanned the ANC, unconditionally released all political prisoners, and removed the troops from the townships. A decision to talk to the government was of such import that it should only have been made in Lusaka. But I felt that the process needed to begin, and that I had neither the time nor the means to communicate fully with Oliver. Someone from our side needed to take the first step, and my new isolation gave me both the freedom to do so and the assurance, at least for a while, of the confidentiality of my efforts. I was now in a kind of splendid isolation. Though my colleagues were only three floors above me, they might as well have been in Johannesburg. In order to see them, I had to put in a formal request for a visit, which had to be approved by the head office in Pretoria. it often took weeks to receive a response. If it was approved, I would then meet them in the visiting area. This was a novel experience. My comrades and fellow prisoners were now official visitors. For years we had been able to talk for hours a day. Now we had to make official requests and appointments, and our conversations were monitored. After I had been in my new cell for a few days, I asked the commanding officer to arrange such a meeting. He did so, and the four of us discussed the issue of my transfer. Walter, Kathy, and Ray were angry that we had been separated. They wanted to lodge a strong protest and demand that we be reunited. My response was not what they expected. "Look, chaps," I said, "I don't think we should oppose this thing. I mentioned that my new accommodations were superior, and maybe this would set a precedent for all political prisoners." I then added somewhat ambiguously, "Perhaps something good will come of this. I'm now in a position where the government can make an approach to us." They did not care too much for this latter explanation, as I knew they would not. I chose to tell no one of what I was about to do. Not my colleagues upstairs or those in Lusaka. The ANC is a collective, but the government had made collectivity in this case impossible. I did not have the security or the time to discuss these issues with my organization. I knew that my colleagues upstairs would condemn my proposal, and that would kill my initiative even before it was born. There are times when a leader must move out ahead of the flock, go off in a new direction, confident that he is leading his people the right way. Finally, my isolation furnished my organization with an excuse in case matters went awry. The old man was alone and completely cut off, and his actions were taken by him as an individual, not a representative of the ANC. Chapter 90. Within a few weeks of my move, I wrote to Kobi Kotze to propose talks about talks. As before, I received no response. I wrote once more, and again there was no response. I found this peculiar and demoralizing, and I realized I had to look for another opportunity to be heard. That came in early 1986. At a meeting of the British Commonwealth in Nassau in October 1985, the leaders could not reach agreement on whether to participate in international sanctions against South Africa. This was mainly because British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was adamantly opposed. To resolve the deadlock, the assembled nations agreed that a delegation of eminent persons would visit South Africa and report back on whether sanctions were the appropriate tool to help bring about the end of apartheid. In early 1986, the seven-member eminent persons group, led by General Olusegun Obasanjo, the former military leader of Nigeria, and former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, arrived in South Africa on their fact-finding mission. In February, I was visited by General Obasanjo to discuss the nature of the delegation's brief. He was eager to facilitate a meeting between me and the full group. With the government's permission, such a meeting was scheduled for May. The group would be talking with the cabinet after they saw me, and I viewed this as a chance to raise the subject of negotiations. The government regarded my session with the group as something extraordinary. 2 days before the meeting, I was visited by Brigadier Monroe, who had brought along a tailor. "Mandela," the commander said, "we want you to see these people on an equal footing. We don't want you to wear those old prison clothes. So this tailor will take your measurements and outfit you with a proper suit." The tailor must have been some kind of wizard, for the very next day, I tried on a pinstriped suit that fit me like a glove. I was also given a shirt, tie, shoes, socks, and underwear. The commander admired my new attire. "Mandela, you look like a prime minister now, not a prisoner," he said, and smiled. At the meeting between myself and the eminent persons group, we were joined by two significant observers, Kobi Kotze and Lieutenant General W.H. Willems, the Commissioner of Prisons. Like the tailor, these two men were there to take my measure. but curiously, they left shortly after the session started. I pressed them to remain, saying I had nothing to hide, but they left anyway. Before they took their leave, I told them the time had come for negotiations, not fighting, and that the government and the ANC should sit down and talk. The Eminent Persons Group had come with many questions involving the issues of violence, negotiations, and international sanctions. At the outset, I set the ground rules for our discussions. I am not the head of the movement, I told them. The head of the movement is Oliver Tambo in Lusaka. You must go and see him. You can tell him what my views are, but they are my personal views alone. They don't even represent the views of my colleagues here in prison. All that being said, I favor the ANC beginning discussions with the government. Various members of the group had concerns about my political ideology and what a South Africa under ANC leadership might look like. I told them I was a South African nationalist, not a communist, that nationalists came in every hue and color, and that I was firmly committed to a non-racial society. I told them I believed in the Freedom Charter, that the Charter embodied principles of democracy and human rights, and that it was not a blueprint for socialism. I spoke of my concern that the white minority feel a sense of security in any new South Africa. I told them I thought many of our problems were a result of lack of communication between the government and the ANC, and that some of these could be resolved through actual talks. They questioned me extensively on the issue of violence, and while I was not yet willing to renounce violence, I affirmed in the strongest possible terms that violence could never be the ultimate solution to the situation in South Africa, and that men and women, by their very nature, required some kind of negotiated understanding. While I once again reiterated that these were my views and not those of the ANC, I suggested that if the government withdrew the army and the police from the townships, the ANC might agree to a suspension of the armed struggle as a prelude to talks. I told them that my release alone would not stem the violence in the country or stimulate negotiations. After the group finished with me, they planned to see both Oliver in Lusaka and government officials in Pretoria. In my remarks, I had sent messages to both places. I wanted the government to see that under the right circumstances, we would talk, and I wanted Oliver to know that my position and his were the same. In May, the Eminent Persons Group was scheduled to see me one last time. I was optimistic as they had been to both Lusaka and Pretoria, and I hoped that the seed of negotiations had been planted. But the day before we were to meet, the South African government took a step that sabotaged whatever goodwill had been engendered by the Commonwealth visitors. On the day the Eminent Persons Group was scheduled to meet with cabinet ministers, the South African Defense Force, under the orders of President Botha, launched air raids and commando attacks on ANC bases in Botswana, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. This utterly poisoned the talks, and the Eminent Persons Group immediately left South Africa. Once again, I felt my efforts to move negotiations forward had stalled. Oliver Tambo and the ANC had called for the people of South Africa to render the country ungovernable, and the people were obliging. The state of unrest and political violence was reaching new heights. The anger of the masses was unrestrained. The townships were in upheaval. International pressure was growing stronger every day. On June 12, 1986, the government imposed a state of emergency in an attempt to keep a lid on protest. In every outward way, the time seemed inauspicious for negotiations. But often, the most discouraging moments are precisely the time to launch an initiative. At such times, people are searching for a way out of their dilemma. That month, I wrote a very simple letter to General Willemse, the Commissioner of Prisons. In it, I merely said, I wish to see you on a matter of national importance. I handed the letter to Brigadier Munro on a Wednesday. That weekend, I was told by the commanding officer to be prepared to see General Willemse, who was coming down from Pretoria. This meeting was not treated in the usual fashion. Instead of conferring with the general in the visiting area, I was taken to his residence on the grounds of Polesmoor itself. Willems is a direct